The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
I think the increased availability of extraordinarily lethal weaponry is what makes domestic violent extremism and domestic terrorism such a serious priority for the Justice Department and DHS and of concern to the country. We are putting a significant amount of money into our investigations of domestic violent extremist terrorist groups. We have a budget request of $1.6 billion for ATF for the work that it does, and another request for $401 million for state and local grants. We have just issued a notice of proposed rulemaking with respect to ghost guns, which, as you point out, do not have serial numbers, but equally important, because they are sold as kits, it's not necessarily clear that they were subject to background checks when they were sold. So under the rule, they would both be subject to background checks, and the manufacturers would be required to put serial numbers on them, and a licensed firearms dealer who comes into possession of one without a serial number would be required to put one on it.
I'm Ruhini Kurup, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, May 14th, 2021. On Wednesday, Attorney General Merrick Garland and Secretary of Homeland Security Alejandro Mayorkas testified on domestic violent extremism before the Senate Appropriations Committee. They talked about what they consider the most pressing threats and answered senators' questions about what their agencies are doing about them. There were also some questions about other topics, such as border security, and their testimony included opening statements and repetition. We took it all out to give you just the questions and answers on domestic violent extremism. It's the Lawfare Podcast, May 14th. Garland and Mayorkas on domestic violent extremism with No Bull.
Secretary Mayorkas, you talked about this internal review. You have to detect and respond to domestic violent extremism within the Department of Homeland Security. That sends chills down my spine that we have to even be doing that. Will you commit to making the results of that review available to the Congress and the American public?
Mr. Chairman, I certainly will. It is vitally important that our department reflects the nation that we seek to achieve, protect, and keep secure.
Thank you. And Attorney General Garland, I mentioned earlier you were the lead prosecutor in the Oklahoma City bombing case. And in some ways that feels like that was yesterday, but I'm sure even more so to you, you had a pretty unique perspective into our country's efforts to counter domestic violent extremism. When you commemorated the 26th anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing last month, you noted that, quote, the terror we face then is still with us. And it appears to me that the threat has evolved in part because of violent extremist groups. So my question to you, Attorney General, how would the Justice Department adapt its approach to combating domestic violent extremism to address how the threat has evolved over the past few years?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and that is an excellent question. That's what we've been working on for several months, and something that the department has been working on over the years. That threat has changed. There are a lot of different factors that have made it change, but of course the most significant is the ability to communicate over the internet at high speed and to be able to communicate in secret through encrypted and other channels. In the days of Oklahoma City, the co-conspirators had to meet together, and it took a considerable amount of time. In addition, the degree of lethal weaponry available now is substantially higher than it was then. Then it took 2,000 pounds of ammonium nitrate to bring down that building. It would take considerably less of modern explosives to do the same. So that threat is considerably, with respect to its risk of lethality, higher than it ever was. We are using all the lessons that were learned over the past decades, including those involved in fighting foreign terrorists in the United States. We have much more robust intelligence situation than we had then. We have much more joint sharing of information between state and local agencies and the federal government. The FBI has joint task forces across the country of about 100 or so, covering every field office and many more. The U.S. Attorney's offices likewise have joint anti-terrorism task forces that work with state and local law enforcement, sharing information all the time. And we're giving out considerable amounts of grants to help the state and local and territorial and tribal law enforcement to up their game in recognizing these kind of threats as well.
Okay.
Mr. Attorney General, federal law defines domestic terrorism as a violation of the criminal laws of the U.S. or any state that appears intended to intimidate or coerce. As I said in my opening statement, that was the case with the events of January the 6th, and the individual who committed those acts should be punished to the fullest extent of the law. I believe that. At the same time, sir, I'm trying to understand the difference between those acts and the ones perpetuated last summer by groups like Antifa and others that rioted, vandalized, and frankly terrorized cities like Portland, Minneapolis, and Washington, D.C., all in an effort to deliver, as they say, a message. My question is this. Sir, what is the actual difference between these acts besides the groups carrying them out? And if there is not one, how can you assure this committee and the American people that the Department of Justice, under your leadership, is pursuing all who commit such acts with equal vigor? In other words, you're not selectively prosecuting, but you're going after all lawbreakers.
Senator, as I said in my opening statement, and as you said in your statement, the role of the Justice Department is prosecute, to investigate and prosecute violations of the criminal law, regardless of ideology. Your quotation from Director Wray is one I would join myself, that we don't care what the ideology is. Violations of law are pursued and are prosecuted. I think it is fair to say that in my career as a judge and in law enforcement, I have not seen a more dangerous threat to democracy than the invasion of the Capitol. This was an attempt by some, and I want to be very careful to not ascribe it to all because every case is individually decided. But there was an attempt to interfere with the fundamental passing element of our democracy, the peaceful transfer of power. And if there has to be a hierarchy of things that we prioritize, this would be the one we prioritize because it is the most dangerous threat to our democracy. But that does not mean that we don't focus on other threats and that we don't focus on other crimes. We do, and we don't care about the ideology behind them.
Is rioting and pilfering and all of this in our cities, where it breaks the law, is that subject to prosecution?
Of course, anything that breaks
just
the law.
Just like any other break.
Anything that breaks the law is subject to prosecution. It may not be subject to federal prosecution. There has to be a federal crime involved, but if it breaks the law, of course, it's subject to
prosecution. But a lot of it could be subject to federal
prosecution. It could. Yes, absolutely it could. And the Justice Department looks for where there are violations of federal crimes.
Attorney General, you've identified the dilemma of democracy, where we state unequivocally you can believe what you care to believe. That's your right in this country, this free country. But when you take action in pursuance of your beliefs, then we have to take a critical eye toward that action to determine whether or not it has broken the law and endangers the rights of others. During the January 6th insurrection, New York Police Department Officer Thomas Webster has been charged with assaulting a D.C. Metropolitan Police Department officer during the attack. Body camera footage shows Webster attacking the Metropolitan Police Department officer with a metal flagpole, tackling him and trying to rip off his face shield and gas mask. This raises a question which is painful to consider, but we have to consider, and that is whether or not in the ranks of law enforcement, either at the federal level or state and local level, there are those who would use their political beliefs in a manner which is inconsistent with your earlier statement. What are your thoughts about how we can deal with this?
Well, you put your finger on the most difficult problem we have, which is balancing First Amendment, free association, free speech rights with protection of our communities against criminal acts. Within the Justice Department itself, we are beginning our own review of our procedures. Over the last couple of weeks, we've been discussing how to go about this. The Deputy Attorney General has met with the heads of all of our law enforcement agencies to determine how we can carefully vet our own employees. Again, always being mindful of First Amendment and free associational rights. But at the same time, being careful that we don't have people in our ranks who would commit criminal acts or who are not able to carry on their duties. So that's one set of things, looking within ourselves. And the second are we have, with respect to our joint terrorism task forces, we have a vetting procedure like we have for our own agents with respect to careful backgrounds. But with respect to law enforcement of the local and state level, this would require using some of our grant money for the purpose of incentivizing anti-domestic violent extremist training of people so that law enforcement is aware what to look for and of how to go about the kind of training necessary to make sure that people who are involved in it are excluded from the ranks.
Thank you. Secretary Mayorkas, Senator Shelby raised a question earlier about 19,000 people who were caught and released by your agency at the southern border, and I want to give you a chance to respond to that. And would you also comment on the chart that says there are thousands of migrant children in U.S. custody so that the record can be clear as to whether that is accurate?
Thank you, Senator Durbin. As I mentioned earlier, our priority is to secure the border. In a time of pandemic, we are employing the Department of Health and Human Services, specifically the Center for Disease Control's Title 42 authority, to expel families and single adults. We made a decision because the president and this administration is dedicated not only to a safe and orderly immigration system, but one that is humane as well, to not expel children. Families who are not able to be expelled are placed in immigration proceedings pursuant to the law.
Does that mean they have a court date?
That is indeed the case. They do have a court date. And if they are not able, we are not able to identify a court date at the time that they are apprehended in a Customs and Border Protection facility, a Border Patrol station, they are issued a notice to appear at an Immigration and Customs Enforcement facility. With respect to the photograph that I have trouble seeing, but I do I can discern what it is. We have focused our efforts on ensuring that children are moved as quickly as possible from a Border Patrol station to the shelter and care of the Department of Health and Human Services. I have repeatedly stated that a Border Patrol station is no place for a child. We have made dramatic improvement in the movement of those unaccompanied children to the Department of Health and Human Services. We've reduced the time in Border Patrol custody from a height of 133 hours on average on March 28th to an average below 30 hours as I sit here and testify today. And those facilities are far better than a Border Patrol station, and we are likewise reducing the time that a child spends in an HHS facility so that we can unite that child with a parent, legal guardian, or family relative qualified sponsor here in the United States.
But you do not forcibly remove children from their families, do you?
We absolutely do not continue the cruel and extraordinarily inhumane policy of the past.
And you do make every effort to establish a reunification possibility.
We are dedicated to that. We are very proud of the fact that we reunited four families last week. And I want to acknowledge that that is only the beginning, Senator.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Attorney General, welcome.
Thank you.
I commend you and the Department of Justice for seeking to identify and prosecute those responsible for the terrible riots and attack on our Capitol on January 6. As the chairman mentioned, starting last summer, our country also experienced attacks threatening other significant government institutions, such as a courthouse, police stations. That occurred in Minneapolis and in what we in Maine call the other Portland. You have made very clear that the ideological outlook of the individual committing these alleged crimes is not important to the Department of Justice. But what resources has the department dedicated to identifying and prosecuting the individuals responsible for the violent acts last summer that were aimed at institutions like courthouses and police stations?
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Thank you, Senator, for the question. As you might expect, I know more about the resources we're putting into January 6th because most of those resources have been put in on my watch during the time I've been here. I wasn't the Attorney General nor in the Department of Justice in the summer, so I'm not completely familiar with the resources that were put in during that period. But the U.S. Attorney's offices in both in the other Portland and in Minneapolis are continuing to work those cases, as is the FBI field offices in both of those cases. And I have not heard any suggestion that insufficient resources are available for those continuing prosecutions.
If you could get back to me with more specifics on that, I'd really appreciate it.
I'll ask my staff to contact yours.
You have described misinformation, and disinformation as fueling a great deal of this violent extremist activity. In your view, would a commission to provide information literacy tools that people can use to make sounder judgments about what they're seeing on social media, and this would apply to all communities, but there's a particular concern with veterans and service members. Would such a commission be useful, Mr. General, for police?
Look, I think all forms of civics education that help provide education about misinformation that can lead to radicalization or misinformation in general would be helpful.
Thank you. Ms. Secretary?
Senator Reid would welcome the opportunity to learn the specifics. We're eager to have additional resources and additional vehicles to address misinformation and disinformation. I should say that our department is partnering with the Department of Education to develop a program in the K through 12 arena. And so to amplify that effort, we would welcome the opportunity to study the commission of which you speak.
Thank you, Mr. Secretary. Mr. Secretary, we have also seen increasing evidence that Russia is using this type of misinformation and disinformation to support and amplify a message of violence that we saw in Charlottesville, in the killing of George Floyd, designed to disunite this country, inflame racial tensions, and to undermine, in many respects, our democracy. And a recent joint assessment indicates that they are using the January 6th assault on the Capitol in such a manner to amplify narratives in furtherance of their policy, which is to disrupt and disunite and to, indeed destroy, if they could, our democracy. So are you concerned about this nexus between Russia and these domestic terrorists?
Very much so, Senator. We are intensely focused on the information with respect to Russia's effort to sow discord and disunity in our country. And, of course, we are bringing in all of government effort to respond to that. And I would welcome the opportunity to brief you in a more appropriate forum to address the information we have in that regard.
In this forum, can you give an indication of what you think the best way might be to do that?
Senator, some of the actions that we have taken certainly are public. We have imposed sanctions. We have attributed to Russia publicly the actions that we have learned they have committed. Those are two examples that I certainly can speak of in a public forum.
Thank you. One of my impressions from being on the Armed Services Committee is that there is a disconnect between our defense-related intelligence services, the Cybercom, NAS, CIA, et cetera, many because of constitutional issues of the inability of these agencies to operate in the United States. Has that left a seam in which it is being exploited, and are we making efforts to close that seam constitutionally?
Senator, you are correct in addressing the fact that some authorities are domestic in nature, others are not. The issue of seams, of course, is a longstanding one. We are very, very focused on closing any seams that remain or any residual of past issues. We're very, very focused on and developing resources to address that.
Well, Ms. Secretary and Mr. Attorney General, if there are legislative initiatives that are required to close these seams or to disrupt the flow of disinformation, please forward those to not just this committee, but to other committees of jurisdiction and interest.
Following the events of January 6th, a couple weeks ago, the FBI executed a search warrant on a couple living in Homer, Alaska, related to the investigation surrounding the events of January 6th. The search warrant was unsealed just last week, We've had an opportunity to take a look at it. We now understand that the wife was or has been identified as a person that the FBI believes may have been connected to the laptop of Speaker Pelosi based on a picture and at least two tips. The couple in Homer adamantly assert that this is a case of mistaken identity. Certainly a lot of back and forth going on as to whether or not that is the case. But understanding that this investigation is ongoing, how are the Department of Justice and Homeland Security working with the FBI and others to ensure that while we have a thorough investigation that is ongoing, that it respects the constitutional rights of all Alaskans in this case, but all Americans. But part of this is just to ensure that public trust in law enforcement is maintained during the course of this investigation. There's a lot of discussion about how long is it going to take until this investigation is concluded. You have a small town in a state with a small population, and there's a lot of discussion about the merits of this going forward. So if you can address that, please.
Look, I think this is the central question for all of law enforcement, to always be careful, to balance. Balance isn't even the right word. The right word is to pursue law enforcement objectives consistent with the statutes of the United States and the Constitution. This is exactly what we endeavor to do in Oklahoma City, facing enormous number of deaths and injuries. But we took care at each step to make sure that the law was followed. We are doing the same with respect to the January 6th investigation. The U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of Columbia is the lead force along on the prosecution side, and the FBI on the law enforcement side. Both are subject to ongoing supervision by the National Security Division and the Justice Department, by the Deputy Attorney General and myself. So we take your point completely. I can't talk as you obviously recognize about a particular case, but we look carefully and we will revise our perceptions as new facts arise. I can't tell you how long this will take. This is only at this point around 145 days or so. It's relatively short in the lifetime of an investigation. Particularly one that has required such a large number of separate investigations in different places as far-flung as Alaska, and a huge amount of data to be examined in a video that's been made available. The investigation is not over, and we will pursue each lead till we're confident that we have reached the end.
Today.
Secretary Mayorkas, you noted in your testimony that you're increasing your department's efforts to assess how domestic extremists are leveraging social media and other online platforms. Can you tell us more about those efforts?
Thank you very much, Senator. The challenge really is, number one, the anonymity with which people are able to navigate through social media and really exploit the medium for improper and unlawful purposes, and two, the speed with which they can do so. And so what we are doing is dedicating analysts to understanding the narratives that are being communicated on the social media platforms and identifying linkages between those narratives and indicators of intention to commit violent acts. Right now, we are doing that through the human resource, not yet leveraging algorithms, but we are, of course, planning different methodologies as we proceed in this endeavor.
Attorney General Garland, you and other leaders, in fact, Chris Wray at the FBI, has also spoken about self-radicalization. And I assume that what that really means is folks who are largely sitting at home and consuming hours and hours of extremist content through YouTube and Facebook and other social media platforms. Would you agree that if platforms have algorithms that are actually designed to hold the attention of viewers and to engage them by delivering more and more extremist content to people who start going down these so-called rabbit holes, then they, perhaps unintentionally, are fueling some of this problem, and we should take some actions to help address that challenge.
Well, I agree with Secretary Mayorkas that what's happening on our social media platforms certainly can lead to self-radicalization. The precise mechanism, I'm no expert on, and I wouldn't want to pretend to be, but self-radicalization does, we've seen it most dangerously with respect to those who are influenced by jihadist websites, who watch those websites over and over again and become persuaded and then self-radicalized. And this accelerates very quickly. Somebody can go from a circumstance where no one around them thinks that they are likely to be a violent extremist to one who then acts out. And I think that this is the way in modern society people get this information is through the internet.
And I notice an increase in budgetary requests in both of your departments to fund grant programs that build state and local capacity and to increase funding for U.S. attorney's offices. Will any of that go towards further research on this exact point? And will any of that go to help focus on what the mental health issues are that might make people more vulnerable to recruitment or radicalization, and what the local initiatives might be that could help tamp down or deter radicalization?
If I may, if I may take that, Senator Coons, a few efforts, if I may. Number one, we help resource centers of excellence to conduct research in precisely the area that you have identified. We have grant programs to equip and enable local communities to conduct research and also to develop programs that are in fact focused on mental health issues and a holistic approach to the challenge that we face. That is precisely one of the reasons why we actually changed an office's name to become the Center for Prevention Programs and Partnerships. It's about prevention first and foremost, which does include mental health efforts, and partnership, working with our state, local, tribal, territorial partners to equip them in the communities to develop these programs, to develop educational efforts, as well as response and resilience programs.
Thank you. Anything you wanted to add?
Yes, and the same for us. So the National Institute of Justice did a study on just this topic, understanding domestic radicalization and terrorism, which came out last year, which I mentioned in my written statements. We have $4 million in our budget request for them to continue and to do a further analysis of root causes of radicalization.
Secretary Mayorkas, we look forward to seeing you before the subcommittee later this year to talk about the department's budget request. Thank you both for your service to protect the country. I have two questions, three if I have time. The first is with respect to comments that you both made regarding the access that domestic extremist groups have to weapons and bomb-making materials. I would note that the incredibly disturbing story of the 13 individuals in Michigan who were very far along in a plot to kidnap and try for treason the governor of Michigan had in their possession upwards of 70 firearms, an arsenal that included many AR-15-style rifles, ghost guns, guns that are designed by their nature to be untraceable, and 2,000 rounds of ammunition. I'll direct this to you, Attorney General Garland, because you are undergoing right now a review about the ways in which we can make sure that firearms are traceable for law enforcement purposes. You volunteered this in your testimony, as I think Secretary Mayorkas did. What are your concerns regarding the ability of these groups to arm themselves with significant weaponry and weaponry that increasingly is very difficult, if not impossible, to trace?
So I appreciate your picking up on the point that I was making. I think the increased availability of extraordinarily lethal weaponry is what makes domestic violent extremism and domestic terrorism such a serious priority for the Justice Department and DHS and of concern to the country. We are putting a significant amount of money into our investigations of domestic violent extremist terrorist groups. We have a budget request of $1.6 billion for ATF for the work that it does, and another request for $401 million for state and local grants. On the specific question you asked about traceability, we have just issued a notice of proposed rulemaking with respect to ghost guns, which, as you point out, do not have serial numbers, but equally important, they because they are sold as kits, are not necessarily it's not necessarily clear that they were subject to background checks when they were sold. So under the rule, they would both be subject to background checks, and the manufacturers would be required to put serial numbers on them, and a licensed firearms dealer who comes into possession of one without a serial number would be required to put one on it.
I will remind the committee on this general topic that right now, individuals that are on what we would commonly refer to as the terrorist watch list are able to buy weapons in gun stores today. They're not automatically added to the list of those that are prohibited to purchase weapons. It's inconceivable to me that at least on that topic, we cannot find common ground. Turning to the question of the border, Secretary Mayorkas, Senator Shelby raised the question of border security at a hearing about domestic extremism. And I wanted to sort of ask you to give an assessment of the risk of terrorists entering this country through the southern border. Important to remember that undocumented immigrants in this country have a lower arrest rate than U.S. citizens. And from what I can understand, there's fairly scant evidence that international extremist groups are using the southwest border as a mechanism to bring their members into the country. What evidence do we have that the southwest border is being used by international extremist groups or domestic extremist groups to try to bring individuals into this country to do harm to American citizens?
Senator, we don't have any evidence that suggests that the threat on the border with respect to foreign terrorists is any greater today than it was last year, the year prior, or the years over the past decade. The fact of the matter is that we are vigilant in guarding against foreign terrorist influences through all avenues, not just, of course, our land borders, but air and maritime. That is what we do, and fortunately, we have extraordinary capabilities to address it.
There's been reporting of Americans involved with those right-wing extremist groups in the U.S. communicating online and sometimes traveling overseas for training with other extremist groups, and not just in Russia, although we know of at least one leader of the base who has resettled to St. Petersburg, Russia. So can you talk about the extent to which you're seeing an increase, or if you are seeing an increase in those connections, and what we're doing to try and address that?
Yes, Senator.
For either of you.
Yes, Senator. Well, you're right that to be concerned. I can't give a sense of the magnitude of the problem, but I do think that we have to worry about interactions between domestic violent extremists, particularly racially motivated and ethnically motivated ones, where there are similar groups, particularly in Europe, with similar ideological bents, sharing information We have the benefit in that respect of being able to coordinate with our national intelligence partners, and the Director of National Intelligence is very seized with this problem. The seam that was talked about before in one of the other questions is one that we have worked very hard to eliminate, where there is a foreign aspect of the risk, and our intelligence agency partners whose eyes are abroad are being very cooperative in that respect. But we are looking at this problem, and it is very much on our mind.
And if I can add one point, Senator, if I may, the Attorney General and I participated in a multi-nation ministerial, and of course, the issue of violent extremism was uppermost in our minds, and it's something that we share with our partners and are working very closely together with them to address.
One of the potential sources, Secretary Mayorkas, do you think that statements made by public officials claiming that the 2020 presidential election was stolen or the result of fraud increase the threat of violence by domestic extremists? Have we seen that as we're pursuing, also for the Attorney General, as we're pursuing the cases against those people involved on January 6th? Has that been something that we've heard from the defendants?
Senator, first, yes, we can do both. We can secure our border, and we can effectively combat the rise of domestic violent extremism.
Is there any evidence that elected official statements have contributed to that?
We do see in the narratives that we have studied the fact that false narratives attributed to public officials gain traction in social media.
At this point in time, I understood the response to Senator Shaheen's question, and certainly this Intelligence Committee report indicates that those kind of false narratives have dangerous consequences. Is that not true?
Most certainly, and it's something that we're very focused on addressing. False narratives, as I mentioned, create strands of dialogue that we see propagated on social media, and then we see those strands picked up on, and we are detecting connectivity between those strands and an intention to commit violent acts, and that is what we are focused on.
Mr. Attorney General.
Yeah, so if you put it at that level of generality rather than the specific questions about people being investigated in a particular circumstance, it is right, as the intelligence community has reported, that particularly those who end up committing acts of domestic violence get ideas from the internet and from statements, and where there are false narratives and false statements, those are the kind of things that can, depending upon the person in the end who acts out, lead to violence.
Well, look, I disagree with Congresswoman Liz Cheney on a lot of things, but I think everybody needs to stand with her regardless of political party when she stands up to talk about the truth. And what she is saying in her floor remarks squares fully with the finding from this intelligence community report that both your departments participated in. And the report it's not ambiguous here. It says, these kind of false narratives will almost certainly spur domestic violent extremists to try to engage in violence this year. So, Mr. Chairman, I would just encourage all of our colleagues to recognize that words matter. I mean, people have a First Amendment right, and they can say what they want, but they should also recognize the very dangerous consequences of the false narratives that continue to be peddled around this place and coming from the former president.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. The podcast is produced and edited by Jen Pacha Howell, and your audio engineer is Ian Enright of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. Please rate and review the Lawfare Podcast and share us on Twitter and Facebook. As always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.